Gospel according to Luke.
Glory to you, O Lord.
When they had reached the place called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there, together with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. And Jesus said, "Abba, forgive them. They know not what they do." Then they divided his garments, rolling dice for them. The people stood there watching. The rulers, however, jeered him and said, "He saved others. Let him save himself, if he really is the Messiah of God, the Chosen One." The soldiers also mocked him. They served Jesus sour wine and said, "If you are really the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was an inscription above Jesus that read, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there beside him insulted Jesus too, saying, "Are you really the Messiah? Then save yourself and us." But the other answered the first with a rebuke, "Do you not even fear God? We are only paying the price for what we have done, but this one has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus replied, "The truth is, today you will be with me in paradise." The Gospel of Christ.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Please be seated. She had no family. She lived alone. And for the purposes of this sermon, I will call her Sophia. Sophia, the Greek word for wisdom. I became her pastor because she knew somebody who used to be a member here. And when the doctors told her that she was dying, she thought that she ought to have a pastor. I was summoned to her bedside. I was afraid. I had been told that she only had a few weeks before the cancer would take her. To be present to a stranger when they are so close to death is a daunting task. No time for gentle hellos or warming up to one another, just a long, painful, and sometimes awkward goodbye. I went to Sophia's bedside every day. Some days, when she was able, the questions just tumbled out of her. She wanted to know what I believed. No pat or trite platitudes, if you please. Just the facts. I liked her no-nonsense approach, even though I knew that the meager facts that I possessed might not sustain us on our journey. It didn't take very long for me to figure out that she'd spent a great deal of time in and around the church. Her parents saw to it that she was raised in the church, but a lifetime of tragedy and heartache had led her away, far, far away from the faith that she had grown up with. But as death drew near, she longed for the certainty of her youth. "She'd like to believe," she told me. "She'd really, really like to believe. It would be nice to think that there would be a place for her. Not exactly heaven, per se, but someplace heavenly. Perhaps like Paris in the springtime." She so loved Paris in the springtime. If only heaven were full of cafes or patisseries where she could while away the hours talking with others who had an appetite for the finer things of life. Life. Would there be life beyond death, she asked. She'd like to believe so. One morning, I stopped by Edward's Bakery on Main Street, and I picked out some of the most European pastries that I could find, and then I swung by Starbucks and had them grind up some fresh coffee beans. And as I brewed the coffee in Sophia's kitchen, the aroma wafted up the stairs, and she shouted down and she said, in a very dictatorial tone, "Heat up some milk. We need lattes." It was a heavenly breakfast, as heavenly as we could muster, and our conversation took us back to Paris and a springtime before I was born, when Sophia was young and beautiful, and the men were falling at her feet. Some of her stories, many of her stories, made me blush. Not an easy thing to do. We laughed and we laughed and we laughed until we cried. After Paris, we traveled to London by way of some excellent fish and chips and a few glasses of cider. It was cold and wet in London, and Sophia managed to complete her nursing studies, even though a certain young man begged her to give up her work and come be his love. Over sausages and beer, we traveled to Hamburg, where Sophia fell in love with an orphanage full of children. By the time our conversations took us to India, Sophia was too ill for a curry, so we sipped tea as we wept over her stories of poverty and disease. One afternoon, I arrived to find Sophia's care worker crushing ice for mint juleps. It took a while for me to figure out that we were going deep into the southern United States, where Sophia had worked long and hard to help establish a medical center among the poorest of the poor. By the time our travels led us back to Newmarket, Sophia was growing weak, and I had gone from being a suspected Bible thumper to a trusted traveling companion. And the most difficult part of our journey lay ahead of us. "What will become of me?" Sophia asked. I told her that the doctors would see to it that there would be no pain. That wasn't what she meant. What will become of me? Will there just be darkness? Is there a bright light? Will I see it? "I don't know," was all I could muster. Sophia was patient with me. She asked me if I thought there was more to life or if death was the end. "No religious platitudes, if you please, just the facts." It took all my courage to say, "I don't know, Sophia. I believe that we live and we die in God, and that in God all will be well." And Sophia took my hand and she said, "I'm afraid." I didn't know how to comfort her, so I asked, "What are you afraid of, Sophia?" "Not of dying, good God, no. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of being forgotten. Who will remember me?" The people stood there watching. The rulers, however, jeered at Jesus and said, "He saved others. Let him save himself. If he really is the Messiah of God, the chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him. They served Jesus sour wine and said, "If you really are the King of the Jews, then save yourself." There was an inscription above Jesus that read, "This is the King of the Jews." One of the criminals who hung there beside him insulted Jesus too, saying, "Are you really the Messiah? Then save yourself and us." But the other answered the first with a rebuke, "Don't you even fear God? We are only paying the price for what we have done, but this one has done nothing." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus replied, "The truth is, today you will be with me in paradise." "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." What does it mean to be remembered? And what kind of kingdom is Jesus going into? Okay, so I struggle with the notion of Jesus as a king. According to the New Testament, when his friends and neighbors began to approach Jesus with the intention of making him a king, he hightailed it out of there. Jesus ran away from being a king. Pilate called Jesus a king as an insult. And Jesus' teachings reject the very notion of his ever being a king. Christ the King is a title that I dare say Jesus of Nazareth would be uncomfortable with. When Jesus spoke of what the New Testament calls kingdom, he used the Greek word basileia, which is the feminine plural for majesty. A literal translation of basileia would be queendom. But don't worry, I'm not going to call Christ a queen. You see, I don't believe Jesus would have been one for titles. I'm not even sure that he would have worn the title Christ very well. Jesus used the term basileia to refer to the time when justice and not a king would rule supreme. Jesus understood justice to be about right relationships. Basileia is a plural, which in and of itself implies relationship. Several years ago, a Hispanic feminist theologian, Zazie Diaz, it's a name I always get wrong, Zazie Diaz, she suggested that a more accurate, a more literal translation of basileia would be the term kindom. The kingdom of God that Jesus spoke of is the family of God, a family of sisters and brothers of Jesus who embody God. The kingdom of which Jesus spoke goes beyond the ties of family, tribe, or blood. When the fullness of God becomes a day-to-day reality, we will all be sisters and brothers, kin to one another, a family of God dwelling together in the kingdom. Jesus insisted that the kingdom is within all of us. We all have the ability to embody God to one another. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. To be remembered is to be called to mind, or literally to be remembered, to have our members, our various parts, put back together. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. We all want to be remembered. We desperately want to be remembered by those who have gone on before us. We all want to live on in the memories of those we will leave behind. Indeed, we want to remember our very selves. Part of our great fear of dying is that we will disappear into nothingness. Poof, gone, forgotten. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. How do you want to be remembered? Who will remember you? What will they remember? Will you recognize yourself beyond this life? Or will you disappear? Poof, gone, forgotten. So we thrust the title of king upon Jesus, determined that as king, as the Christ, he will at least remember us. Christ, king, titles that come with responsibilities. Like the crowds that surrounded, cheered, and then jeered, and abandoned Jesus, we too are looking for a Savior. Alone upon our own crosses, we too cry out to be remembered. Living in God, we too shall die in God, and in God, all will be well. We don't know what will happen to us when we die. We trust that the goodness of our God will be, as the psalmist insisted, our refuge from nothingness. We will be remembered. We trust that we will remember our very selves. We will not become nothing. Somehow, we know not how, we will be remembered. No religious platitudes, just the facts. Over and over again, Sophia's desperate plea, "Who will remember me?" punctuated our conversations with fear that went beyond belief. No theological words or phrases about believing would suffice. Only the promise to remember her could bring any comfort at all. But who was I to make such a promise? So I hesitated. I tried to calm her fear with words. I tried to explain her fear away. And then one afternoon, Sophia took my hand and asked me about my travels, my loves, my hopes, my dreams, and my fears. She said she wanted to be able to remember me. And I was reluctant. This wasn't supposed to be about me. I was the pastor, the caregiver, and there were lines that all the books say should not be crossed. Sophia didn't care to be cautious. Time was of the essence. She wanted to remember me. And to do this, she needed to know me. So I came out from under the protection of my clerical office, and together we traveled back to the places that had shaped and molded me. And Sophia and I became friends. If only for a brief moment in time, we were kin, each embodying God for the other. A few days passed before she died, and a panic came over her as she feared what might become of her. And once more, holding tightly to my hand, she begged me, "Who will remember me?" And with all my heart, I promised, "I will remember you. Those men in Paris who fell at your feet, they will remember you. The young man who fell in love with you in London, he will remember you. The children of Hamburg and the people of Kentucky, they will remember you. Your friends will remember you." And then I took a long, deep breath and I said it again, "I will remember you." And her breathing calmed and her grip loosened and she began to smile. And I asked her, "Sophia, remember me." "I will remember you," she promised. Over the course of the next few hours, her life drew to a close. Sophia and I were kin for one another, embodying the divine for one another, loving one another, remembering one another. "I remember you, my dear. I remember you. We are in God, and God is in us. And together we are kin, and all will be well. I remember you."